The Pastor and the Imam, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, two Nigerians divided by religion, one a Muslim leader, an imam, the other a Christian pastor.
Imam was to me somebody that needs to die. Even if I pray, I will pray for him to die.
But now the two are friends.
Two different people with two different cultures, with two different orientations, they can work together to make the world a better place.
Their story today on the show, plus a Muslim American woman in the Bay Area considers removing her hijab in public.
I thought this is a country where you could practice your religion for free, but I really feel like I can't practice my religion for free if every time I go outside, people are just going to, like, treat me differently.
Those stories, plus the disease that threatens bananas, ahead on The World. How do you bridge a divide based on religion and made worse by extremist violence? In a few minutes, we'll hear from two Nigerians who've managed to do that. We begin, though, with a closer look at America's strategy against ISIS. Under President Obama, the main goal has been to contain the extremist group in Syria and Iraq. But that strategy has come in for heavy criticism after the Paris attacks and the San Bernardino shootings. And this week, Obama's top military commander admitted that ISIS is not contained. Harlene Gambier is a counterterrorism analyst with the Institute for the Study of War in Washington. I asked her if ISIS is actually gaining territory in Syria and Iraq.
Well, they are conducting new campaigns in Syria, certainly. But I think the important thing to note is actually that ISIS is conducting a global strategy. And so it is defending its terrain within Iraq and Syria and launching new campaigns within Syria. But at the same time, it's establishing regional affiliates across North Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia. And it's also conducting a global terror campaign, as we've seen, unfortunately, in the past few months. So it's a mistake to talk about ISIS as just an actor within Iraq and Syria.
If ISIS has a global strategy, what would you advise President Obama to do?
What we really need is a strategy that addresses ISIS or that counters ISIS in each of the three geographic areas that I just noted. So we certainly need to, first and foremost, make sure that we're leaning into the strategy to expel ISIS from its terrain within Iraq and Syria, both by increasing our support to the Iraqi security forces and by actually providing effective support to the moderate Syrian opposition. But at the same time, we also need to look towards the broader region where ISIS affiliates are operating and contain and degrade those affiliates before they gain resiliency to the extent that they could promote ISIS's caliphate project, even if the group was defeated within Iraq and Syria. And of course, we must act against ISIS's radical networks in Europe, the U.S., and Australia, which have shown their ability to attack the U.S. homeland.
Are you talking about boots on the ground in various parts of the world where ISIS is active?
Well, definitely not the sort of mass-scale deployment that some political figures are talking about. What we actually see coming out, the Pentagon has actually proposed a plan for regional basing, looking at places like Spain directed towards North Africa, Afghanistan, Djibouti, Iraq, as potential hubs for intelligence gathering operations and special forces that can help to monitor and halt the expansion of these regional affiliates of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And that's especially important because those groups are still in their nascent stages. They're not at the point where ISIS is within Iraq and Syria. And so early action against them can be extremely effective. But if we sit on our hands and wait, we'll get to a point where the problem spirals out of control.
You've written that part of ISIS's strategy is to, quote, destroy the gray zone. What does that mean?
Well, ISIS has an explicit strategy to terrorize and polarize the West, and by that I mean the U.S. and Europe. So ISIS encourages, and in some cases even resources and directs, as we saw in Paris, terror attacks that aim not only to punish members of the anti-ISIS coalition or groups that are acting against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, but are also meant to destabilize the West through polarization. So ISIS hopes that this constant stream of lone wolf and broader terror attacks can create an environment of fear in which state and social groups really lash out against their Muslim communities, helping to push those communities towards ISIS. ISIS wants to eliminate moderation. It wants to eliminate that gray zone and instead push the world towards its envisioned apocalyptic war.
So what can we expect from ISIS moving forward?
we will see ISIS continue to lean into its regional expansion and international terror campaigns as a means of gaining resiliency outside of Iraq and Syria. I think, you know, ISIS will continue to defend what it has in Iraq and Syria and may even try to expand further into the Western corridor of Syria. But overall, it sort of reached its objective of establishing a caliphate there. More important to it now is its expansionism broadly in the region, where it has multiple affiliates that are gaining strength and where it continues to gain new supporters and launch new attacks in new places like Bangladesh or Tunisia and now Somalia. And so we'll see that movement push out further. And we may even see some of those affiliates become bases or hubs for further projecting of attacks against the West.
Say you had 10 minutes with President Obama. What would you advise him in terms of how he should deal with ISIS?
Well, we need to actually start empowering a broader swath of the Syrian opposition. Many of ISIS's primary territorial strongholds and also its logistics hubs are in Syria, but those groups cannot actually push ISIS out of those areas without more military support, and more military support in which they're allowed to also go after the Syrian regime forces, which support President Bashar al-Assad. That takes us into a broader international discussion about what the United States' position towards President al-Assad should be. And I actually think that it would make a fairly significant statement if the U.S. were to say that they're okay empowering forces that would fight against Assad, because that is actually the only way to deprive ISIS of its territory within Syria as well.
All the things you're talking about are in some ways things that are already going on. There's airstrikes going on. Do you feel like we need to go to boots on the ground?
A strategy to defeat ISIS will actually require some form of more capable ground forces than what we have now. The more important thing to note is that right now we're hitting a moment where Russia in particular is working to undermine a lot of the progress that we've made so far by super empowering President al-Assad and by allowing him to pummel the Syrian opposition to a point where there will not be any viable Syrian ground force that can push against ISIS. And that's fine, but then the conversation that we need to be having is, well, then over the course of the next 15 months, what will we need to do to actually preserve conditions and make sure that the incoming administration doesn't face a situation that's much worse? I hate to say it, but we are in a bad situation in which there is a long-term fight. And ultimately, air power alone can't push ISIS out of its core terrain. We're seeing the Iraqi security forces make some gains against ISIS in Iraq, and we need to continue to support those sorts of operations. And then on the Syrian side, we need to make sure that the only viable partner that we don't have doesn't get destroyed.
Harleen Gambier is a counterterrorism analyst with the Institute for the Study of War in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We've heard a lot about ISIS looting antiquities and destroying historical sites in Iraq and Syria. The extremists often boast of their actions online, but it turns out ISIS isn't the only culprit, at least in Syria. Looting there also happens in areas held by the opposition and those still controlled by the Syrian government. Jesse Cassana has been monitoring all this by using satellite images. He teaches anthropology at Dartmouth College.
In Syria, before the war, looting was illegal. And so if you were caught looting, the punishments were quite severe. You could get sent to prison. And so it was something that happened, but happened kind of in the dark of night, secretly. Once the civil war started and the police were no longer present, looting rapidly expanded. Where that looks to be most prevalent, where we see the most frequent looting activities taking place, are generally in the most anarchic parts of the country, the other opposition groups held areas, as well as in Kurdish areas. In the Syrian regime areas and in ISIS held areas, the overall rate of looting is considerably lower, but we do see much more severe looting at a smaller number of sites.
Have you noticed a difference between how the looting and excavation, if you want to call it that, is done in different areas, whether they're controlled by ISIS, whether they're controlled by rebels or the Syrian government?
the most common kind of looting that we see really everywhere in the country is pretty small in scale. It's what I think of as sort of subsistence level looting, where we're talking about 10 or 15 looting holes that are excavated on archaeological sites. These are often adjacent to modern villages. And so it looks like something that's going on as people are probably desperate and trying to feed their families or hoping to find something. And that's very different from the sort of more organized and extreme kind of looting that we see at a smaller number of sites.
Now, with a war going on in Syria, it's hard to know what exactly is going on, but you mentioned that you're using satellite images. How precise are they? What can you actually see when you use them?
Well, we've been given access to a very large database of satellite imagery that is collected by a company called Digital Globe. They're a private company, but most of their business is through the Department of Defense and other federal agencies. And so what we do is we look at an image that, say, predates the war or is from early in the war and compare it to a recent image. And on the recent image, we can often see holes in the ground. They form dark spots with piles of dirt next to them. We also see other kinds of damage, especially in the form of like earth moving as trenches are dug or parts of these sites are bulldozed away.
Can you then zoom in at all?
Yeah, we can zoom in quite clearly. I mean, you can see individual vehicles and sheep if you look carefully.
You yourself were involved in projects inside the country before the war in Syria began in 2011. Have you been able to observe what's happened at the particular sites you were researching at?
Yeah, absolutely. I directed an archaeological excavation at a site called Tel Karkur, which is located in northwestern Syria, for about 7 years up until the start of the war. That is how I became involved in this project. So one of the first sites I looked at was the site that I used to excavate at. And as early as 2011, in the first year of the war, a large part of the lower tell, where we had been excavating for many years, had been bulldozed and created a series of sort of tank garrisons. So there was about six or seven sort of bulldozed tank bunkers on the site itself. I should say that I worked closely with a large group of people who lived in the adjacent village. They were close friends and employees of our project for many years. And I would talk to them periodically throughout the year. But as soon as the cell phones went out in late 2011, I had no other way of contacting them, and I didn't know what had happened to them. It wasn't until this past summer when I received a call, an email out of the blue, and then spoke on the phone to one of them to find out that they had actually been evicted from their village and were now living as internally displaced refugees somewhere on the Turkish border.
So sort of make your heart sink when you see these photos and hear from people you know there?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. For me, I mean, it's not just when I see a site with tanks on it. I mean, I also have knowledge that means that there's some pretty terrible things happening on the ground to the people who live there.
Jessica Sana teaches anthropology at Dartmouth College. Thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
A quick look ahead now before the break. We have a story coming up about the Sami people in northern Scandinavia. A warming planet is the last thing they want.
The most important thing for me is to keep the winters as cold as possible. The Sami livelihoods like reindeer herding and the river fishing, they are totally dependent on the climate that we have.
That story is coming up later, right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Two religious leaders from Nigeria, a pastor and an imam, traveled together to Boston this week. They flew in via Dubai. The Christian, Pastor James Wuye, moved through the airport rather quickly, although he did have to remove his artificial limb as a security precaution. But his Muslim friend and colleague, Imam Muhammad Ashafa, had a very different airport experience.
I was seated for 2 good hours, checking my document, processing my document to see where am I in the world, where have I been, why are you here, why are you there. I feel strongly that I'm paying a price from those who have hijacked my identity.
The pastor waited for his friend. After all, they've been through a lot together. 2 decades ago, they were leaders of rival militias. Their followers battled each other in the Nigerian city of Kaduna. It sits on a fault line between Christianity and Islam. Pastor Wuye says Christians tend to live on one side of the local river and Muslims on the other.
It's delicately divided across the river. So we have the Muslim in the north, the Christian in the south. And each day, people are striving to build reintegration. But it's quite difficult.
Imam Ashafa, what kind of tensions does that create, or what kind of challenges does it create for those two communities?
Initially, it wasn't so. It was out of fear and our phobia for one another that led us to the Christian move from the northern part to the southern part, and many Muslims from the southern part moving to the northern part. The consequences of this on the community is the spirit of brotherhood, the spirit of working together as a team, as fellow citizens, is being threatened. And that's why we've been working within that framework to see how can others learn from our own experience of saying you do not generalize the crime of one for all, because one has got it wrong and then all of them are wrong.
About two decades ago, in the 1990s, you two were sworn enemies. You had absolutely no interest in talking. In fact, you wanted to get rid of each other. There was no hands across the water, nothing. Can you articulate, Pastor James, what you thought of the imam at that time?
Over the years, we were programmed to hate one another by our so-called religious leaders and politicians who have told us that the other is our enemy. So at that point, imam was to me somebody that need to die. Even if I pray, I will pray for him to die. And that was the scenario before we came together in 1995, when a journalist like you brought us together and said, Pastor, imam, talk. That was the beginning. We didn't plan to work together, but it was by chance that we met.
And imam, what persuaded you that working together was the right thing to do?
I lost my family members in those conflict situations. So I look deep within my own scriptures, and I realize that for me to be a better human being, to be a better Muslim, is ability to work together, to see the other, to see myself in the other, to see the others I perceive as enemies, that they are the same human like me, they have the same feeling I have, they have the same fear, and that is why we are working together in the last 20 years. Two different people with two different cultures, with two different orientations, they can work together to create a safe space for all of us.
You're both here in the U.S. to offer strategies on interreligious peace building, and many Americans feel that they're living in a time of uncertainty, and how do you deal with violent extremism? How do you know who's good and who's not? What are you recommending as ways for Americans to be concerned about external threats but still have empathy and be tolerant of Muslim Americans, of which there are millions?
Yeah, for me, the word tolerance connotes negativity. I think they should accept people with their differences.
We need to recognize that America has a value that the whole world, nations around the world share. They cherished. They want to be part of it. This is the values of being diversity in action. First and foremost, I feel this is the time for American Muslims to wake up and explain what Islam really is from what it is not. It's time for religious leaders around the world to raise up their voices and say, no, that is not us and that cannot be us.
You two are religious people, you're religious leaders, and yet at a certain point in your life, you wanted to kill each other, and you in many ways were preaching hate. This is similar to what many people are perceiving ISIS followers to have, that in the name of religion, they're preaching hate. What would you say to an alienated Muslim American or an alienated Muslim in Britain or Brussels or Paris? What would you say to them as somebody who's been in that spot of using religion to foment hate? How do you turn that around?
Religion is a positive tool. It depends on those who are in the driving seat. The Muslim World League, as a Christian, I was invited to address about 2,000 Islamic clerics of high repute in Nigeria a couple of years back. Now, this operation gave me the platform to explain my faith to them and they understanding my position. So I think generally it is better to dialogue. And I think the American Muslims now need to come out and collaborate with American people, those who are not in fear, to allay their fears. And if there are strangers among them that do not understand, they should collaborate to expose those strangers to enable to nip those who have tendency to be violent. And I think this is where faith communities come in action and they can stop this thing through really sincere collaboration and sincere dialogue.
But that requires identifying those people at risk of coming under the influence of ISIS. And as an imam, how do you do that? What is the role of a mosque or religious leaders? Because many Muslim Americans resent the idea that it's up to them to solve this.
The first and foremost is the religious leaders themselves. Who are those who are preaching hate in their community? These are the imams that we need to focus upon.
And then who are those youths who are prone to solidarity for this sort of groups, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Boko Haram, who have a sympathetic tendency towards sympathizing for those negative causes? These are youth in the communities. It is time for the imams in America to move faith into action. House to house, town hall meetings with their communities, and interfaith engagement with other non-Muslim communities, discussing the core values. I think it's time for the Muslim leaders to start talking and extending their hands to our other Christian, Jews, Hindu, Buddhist, Shinto, humanist.
I have one last question. We'll start with Pastor James. Do your strategies work for non-religious people, secular people?
What we can offer to a secular nation or those who are multi-religious nation is to say the human person is one person. The religious leaders in the community need to see those who have strange behaviors and begin to question them and begin to work with them. You don't scare them away. When you scare them away, you make them more violent. So you bring them to yourself, disempower them through use of love, not weapon. Weapons begets weapon, but love begets love.
The greatest weapon of conquering the enemy is turning him into a friend. Once upon a time, myself and Pastor James were the worst of enemy. Today, we are the best of friends. Most of these guys who have strayed from the path, who have chosen destructive tendencies, we need to find a better means. As we use the stick, we should also use the carrot to get them closer and show them the way out. It's about the human dignity. How do we reconnect your humanity? How do we redeem our humanity?
Pastor James Mauvel-Wouye and Imam Muhammad Noran Ashafa are co-executive directors of the Interfaith Mediation Center in Kaduna, Nigeria. Thank you both for being with us today.
The pleasure is ours. Peace be to America.
Assalamu alaikum, American people.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Banana lovers, beware. That yellow snack on your store shelf is called the Cavendish, and it's under threat from a fungus.
The challenge is we don't have another banana in its place ready to go to offer in its stead.
And the same may go for coffee, too. Breakfast is about to get interesting. Ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Nearly 200 countries have official delegations at the UN climate negotiations in Paris. Getting all of them to agree on a final document by end of day tomorrow? Well, we'll see. But the summit isn't just about the diplomats negotiating a deal. There's also a huge number of observers trying to influence the outcome. The World's Carolyn Beeler followed one group of them in Paris this week.
The halls of the UN conference site just outside Paris are a sea of dark suits. Men and women, young and old, delegates from the global north and the south, lots of them are wearing dark suits. So you notice when Ayla Yavo walks through the crowd in her traditional dress with a red fringe, bright red shawl, and big jingling silver brooches.
It's to show everyone that I'm indigenous. You know, the Sami people, we have light hair, blue eyes, some of us. It's not very easy to see that we are indigenous if we are not wearing our traditional dress.
Yavo is the president of the Sami Council. That's a non-governmental organization for the Sami people who span four countries across northern Scandinavia and Russia. Yavo's from Norway, but her clothes signal her concern that Norway's delegates aren't fully representing the Sami people.
No, they are not. And we are very disappointed of them right now.
Yavo's main objective here is for the agreement to include protections for human and indigenous rights as countries fight climate change. But it's looking unlikely that will make it into the main body of the text.
So we're still hoping that some countries will manage to keep it in the final agreement, but it's been very difficult.
Yavo is one of thousands of official observers here. They're allowed inside the secured UN conference center, but not the high-level negotiations. Now, as chaotic as these meetings are, it would be even more chaotic here if every interested party actually got a seat at the negotiating table. But another Sami observer, Jan Sayets, points out this system of indirect participation also has its flaws.
there are so many events happening at the same time, and nobody seems to know who is attending what meeting at the moment. So nobody knows who to try to lobby. So that is really a challenge.
Saitz is from a reindeer herding family in northern Finland, and like Yavo, he has one main objective here.
The most important thing for me is to keep the winters as cold as possible. The Sami livelihoods like reindeer herding and the river fishing, they are totally dependent on the climate that we have. We already see effects.
Changing precipitation patterns mean lichen that reindeer eat is increasingly getting trapped under ice that forms from freezing rain.
So they cannot dig the ground lichen. And in wintertime, there has been more snow than normal. And that has made it, again, impossible or very tiresome to get the ground lichen.
That's right. A warming climate can actually mean more snow in some places. So to keep reindeer herding viable, science wants an agreement here to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That target is in play in the final days, but negotiators may still settle on a softer 2-degree target. I talked to science at the civil society space close to the negotiations just before a workshop on traditional Sami singing.
So it goes a bit higher. So.
Side events like this one are another way special interest groups try to increase their visibility.
We can try that.
Just a few feet from this workshop, there's another Sami event, a screening of a film by director Silja Sambi.
The screening of your film, do you think that is going to have an impact on the outcomes here?
I wish. No, the screening of my film will not affect directly, but when we are making ourselves visible, our hope is that that will make some awareness that there are actually indigenous peoples and that we will all be impacted by climate change.
And so the Sami and hundreds of other unofficial voices here struggle to be heard above the din.
Maybe then the world will wake up before it's too late.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler at the UN Climate Conference, Paris.
Camilla Anderson with our partners at the Ground Truth Project helped produce that story. You can see her photos of the Sami in Paris and in their homeland at PRI.org. Now here's a wake-up call about bananas, world's most popular fruit, but they're under threat from a fungus that's spreading through plantations worldwide. Simran Sethi joins us now to separate banana fact from fiction. She's written about what she calls the slow loss of foods we love, including potentially bananas. First off, Simran, the banana we're talking about is the kind of banana we see in markets everywhere and that I buy almost weekly, isn't it?
It is. It's surprisingly, Carol, the one banana that we see. Thousands of bananas are grown throughout the world, but only one makes it to store shelves, and it's a banana known as the Cavendish. You know, it's the yellow banana you've seen. It's not terribly sweet, and it actually is the replacement banana for the banana, the one banana that used to be on store shelves, which was the Gros Michel back in the 1960s.
So what's interesting in this story is that a disease destroyed the Gros Michel, or Big Mike banana, as it was known, and now a variant of that same disease is maybe threatening the Cavendish?
Exactly. In the 1950s, that soil fungus wiped out the Gros Michel, and here it is again, Tropical Race 4, which is a strain of the exact same fungus that's now wiping out the Cavendish. The challenge is we don't have another banana in its place ready to go to offer in its stead.
At this point, has the disease ruined banana crops in certain parts of the world and it's difficult to get bananas there, but so far in Latin America, the source of most of our bananas, is that safe?
The source of most of our bananas in Latin America is also starting to suffer from this. I had the opportunity to visit banana plantations in Ecuador that were growing both organic bananas and bananas that were treated with pesticides and herbicides. And it's remarkable what is happening now to the entire industry. I mean, 15% of bananas throughout the world are exported in places like Ecuador. It's one of the top exports. We're talking about something that is going to cripple economies and that we've not only seen with the banana, but we're seeing with multiple foods slowly. They haven't yet reached maybe our store shelves here in the United States, but the producing countries are really starting to suffer.
And from what I understand, this is a monoculture crop.
That is correct.
Which makes it more vulnerable to the disease. Is that correct?
Increasingly, most of our food is grown in monoculture as monocrops. It's an efficient way to be able to irrigate everything at the same time, treat everything at the same time. But what you know, we can also understand is if one disease comes in or one pest comes in, it wipes out everything. And we've seen this happen before. We're seeing this happen now with coffee. We saw this happen with the Irish potato famine. And slowly, slowly, all these crops that are being grown in monoculture throughout the world are starting to suffer from various types of changes that were in some cases unanticipated, and certainly ones that are wreaking more havoc than we would have expected had we grown crops biodiversely, grown multiple crops together.
Do you agree with some experts who predict that the Cavendish banana that we're all used to is going to go extinct?
Sadly, I do feel like we're maybe going to be losing our banana. And the beautiful thing is there are areas of the world that have been maintaining biodiversity of bananas, and we'll be able to look into those gene pools and see what we can find. But if we think that there's going to be an immediate replacement that will be shelf stable and ready to travel the way our mighty Cavendish has, I think we might be in for some challenges and disappointment.
Are people working on a replacement for the Cavendish now?
People are working on a replacement, but it's just not happening quickly enough. And, you know, with climate change in particular, the banana is the bellwether. You know, as the globe warms up, we're seeing this disease increase in its intensity, this fungus. So, you know, people are working as hard as they can, but there's quite a bit of unpredictability with what we're seeing with climate variability. And so researchers can only work through what they know. There's climate modeling that shows, you know, this kind of challenge is going to happen to a number of crops, but people are working as hard as they can, but there's just only so much we can do right now.
So my final question is, a year from now, will I still see my favorite banana in the supermarket, or how soon will they suddenly not be around?
That's a really good question, and I wish I could answer it, but it's the same kind of variability that we see with climate change. We don't exactly know what will happen, but what we do know is everything that we see in the grocery store is going to start to shift. This has happened to potatoes with the Irish potato famine. This isn't new. It's happening to coffee. Two countries have declared states of emergency because of coffee leaf rust wiping out coffee plantations, and now we see it with bananas. And this is something that we'll continue to see happening if we don't start to take more proactive measures as eaters and as people who want to support conservation of diversity in foods.
Simran Sethi is author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Thanks, Simran.
Thank you.
A little over a year ago, a far-right populist movement emerged out of the former East German city of Dresden. The Pegida movement, as it's known, attracted huge crowds to its rallies. Protesters denounced what they saw as rising Islamic radicalism and unfettered immigration. Still, many expected Pegida to run out of steam earlier this year. Then came the refugee crisis, with more than a million people streaming into Germany in just a few months. Now, Pegida is back. The World's Matthew Bell has the story from Dresden.
The cold and the rain didn't keep people away from a recent Pegida rally in Dresden's city center. Several thousand people came out to hear speakers rail against the threats posed by Islam and Muslim immigration. One speaker from a far-right party in England told the protesters they're part of something big.
Dresden and Germany was and still is an inspiration for this movement. So is it appropriate to announce here this new unity for saving of Europe?
What's this movement all about? Resistance, the crowd chants. Resistance.
Wir sind 89 nicht auf die Straße gegangen dafür, dass wir das jetzt.
Dieter Tartz is a Dresden native who's been going to Pegida rallies since they began. We didn't take to the streets in 1989 for this to happen in Germany today, he says. Most big German cities now have parallel societies where foreign immigrants are the majority in certain areas. We don't want this, he adds, and we're going to say so loudly. Veronica Nowak is also proud that her fellow Dresdeners were among the first to challenge the Soviet-backed East German regime 25 years ago. She has some of the same concerns about immigration, so she started attending Pegida rallies early on, but she has since stopped going.
Im Moment gehe ich nicht mehr auf die Straße, weil mir Pegida zu radikal ist.
They've become too radical, Nowak says.
Also, mir gefällt nicht, dass sämtliche Politiker als...
She says she feels that some of the protesters go too far. They use vulgar language, she says. They accuse German politicians, including Chancellor Angela Merkel, of being traitors who need to be dealt with. That's just too extreme, Nowak says. But immigration, she goes on to say, especially the large numbers of Muslims coming to Germany, this is a big worry for her. The refugee crisis, along with the terrorist attacks in Paris last month, have given the far right in Germany a political boost. Political scientist Werner Patzelt says that's clear from recent gains made by the Alternative for Germany party, or AfD. It's the closest thing Pegida supporters have to a real political party on the national and state level.
The AfD has climbed to numbers like 10-11%, depending on the polling institute, and presumably the AfD will make it into the state parliaments of Rheinland-Pfalz and of Sachsen-Anhalt during the next elections. So this is a success.
Something else that worries Patzelt, he says, is the rise in violent attacks against refugee camps and the homes of asylum seekers. He sees the Pegida movement, which calls itself nonviolent, as a catalyst for this trend.
We are losing the liberal character of our society. We create a climate of mutual distrust, of polarization, and this is so detrimental for our democracy that it is hard to understand why the political class of this country is leading this country consciously into such a direction.
What's missing, Patzelt says, is a serious political discussion at the highest levels about Germany's immigration and asylum policies. It's not happening. And until it does, he adds, the more extreme elements of the political far right will continue to fill the void. Ahead of the Pegida rally, I ask supporter Dieter Tartz if the movement is a little like the candidacy of Donald Trump, who promises to make America great again.
Wir wollen im Prinzip...
Not at all, he says. We don't want to make Germany big and great. That's too aggressive, he adds. We only want to preserve Germany and keep it the way it is. For The World, Matthew Bell, Dresden.
Now, before we take a break, I'm guessing a few of you might still be looking for that perfect gift this holiday season. That's why we asked some of our reporters to share the best books they've read this year. Here's one of them.
Привет. My name is Alina Simone, and I'm a reporter based in New York City. The very best book I read this year was USSR, Diary of a Perestroika Kid, by the author Vladimir Kozlov. It's a roman à clef about a boy coming of age in the Belarusian city of Mogilev, kind of a Soviet catcher in the rye. I loved its gritty descriptions of urban decay and the shadow of the Iron Curtain. But at heart, this is a universal story about the petty humiliations and hard-won triumphs of youth, the million tiny compromises that lie along the road to becoming yourself. It's perfect for the Russophiles in your life and anyone who was ever a teenager. So go read USSR, Diary of a Perestroika Kid. You'll love it. Пока, пока.
You can find our other book suggestions on our Facebook page. Head over to facebook.com/PRI the world to check them out. And feel free to leave a few recommendations of your own. I'm Carol Hills with The World. Earlier, we heard from a Nigerian imam who received extra scrutiny when he arrived at a U.S. airport this week. Well, Muslims already in the country can tell you they're being treated differently too lately.
Just yesterday, a group of Muslims were picnicking at a lake in Castro Valley near Oakland, when a woman just came over yelling anti-Muslim insults and threw coffee at one of the people's faces.
Hannah Baba is with station KALW in San Francisco. She says things are even harder for Muslim women.
They're easy targets because they're visibly Muslim, right? Whereas men are not. Even that long beard that used to be a mark of a Muslim man is now cool here in the Bay. Hipster beards are in. And so it's really the women who have to be careful and vigilant. I recently talked to a man, Moaz Inam. He's married to a woman wearing hijab. And he was saying that we talk about white privilege. He says Muslim men have a non-hijab wearing privilege and that the men in the community really need to start understanding what their women are going through. And there are community conversations and theological conversations now about whether, in times like these, women should not wear the headscarf. We hosted a panel discussion on Islamophobia last week on KALW, And I put that question to a young lady, 17-year-old Palestinian-American from San Francisco. Her name is Nora Abdelal. And I asked her if she considered taking off the headscarf. Here's what she said.
Well, I really have thought about it. I was like, oh my God, this is too much. Maybe I should just take it off. And then I think, well, I thought this is a country where you could practice your religion for free, but I really feel like I can't practice my religion for free if every time I go outside, people are just going to, like, treat me differently.
Hannah, you're Muslim yourself and you wear the hijab. What's it been like for you?
Well, thankfully, so far, I have not been harassed, nor has my family. My friends and I are having conversations about safety and how to talk to our children about Islamophobia. And being of East African descent, my family's from Sudan, we are both Black and Muslim, which is really kind of a double whammy of discrimination nowadays. So I think we have to be extra vigilant. What that means for me, I try to go about my life normally, but I'm just kind of more aware of my surroundings.
Have you thought about taking off the hijab?
I haven't. No, I have not personally, but I know many people who have or have tried to kind of wrap it differently so that you might look closer to perhaps, you know, someone who's just kind of having a wrap with a bun in the back with large hoop earrings and kind of moving away from the typical traditional Muslim look. MuslimGirl.com issued this kind of Muslim woman safety guide, and they were saying keep a baseball cap handy in the car, keep a beanie handy in the car. You might want to wear one of those instead of the hijab. So me personally, I don't feel I've had to do that so far, but if I feel like I am in danger, I absolutely will.
What have you told your kids?
Oh, I have two girls, and we are having very interesting conversations about this. What I tell them is that, first of all, you know, be proud of who you are, but the reality that we live in times where you might hear something at school, or you might see something, and you come home, you tell us about it, we'll talk about it, and we'll go from there. But honestly, it is very, very difficult to talk to children about this.
Hannah Baba with KALW Radio in San Francisco. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Finally today, we take you to Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood. As the name implies, it's a place rich in Haitian culture. You can literally see that in the colorful murals that line the streets there. Lately, though, a different kind of art has been moving in as gallery owners relocate to Little Haiti to avoid soaring rents elsewhere. Maria Muriel of Station WLRN went looking for one of Little Haiti's main street artists to ask him what he makes of the change.
Marie Jefferson owns a Botanica, an alternative medicine store in Little Haiti. And she wants you to know something about artist Serge Toussaint.
Yes, he's made all of the business beautiful in Little Haiti.
Toussaint's murals adorn innumerable storefronts and even the big Catholic church in the neighborhood, Notre Dame d'Haïti. Almost all his works pay homage to Haitian culture, and some work as billboards at the same time.
Because those are the, these people are like,
recently, I found Toussaint working on a mural off Northwest 54th Street, a main road in Little Haiti.
So I've been driving around Little Haiti, and every mural that to me looks like traditional Haitian art, all of them have your signature.
Exactly, because if you notice it, I could paint any other thing, but I want people that come from out of states, when they come to Little Haiti, when they walk up in here, they have a sense of I am in a Haitian community. That's the reason why I see most of my murals in Little Haiti has something to do with Haitians.
Toussaint takes a lot of pride in that, and he thinks the artist now bringing a more contemporary style to Little Haiti should respect the neighborhood's traditional look.
If you're coming to my community in Little Haiti, you have to mingle your artwork with something that's related to Haitians.
I used to live here for a few years, or when I used to drive around, I would see murals that look like your work, and now I just walk down there, and it's covered up. It's a different business.
If someone else will rent the building, you gotta accept that. They're gonna have to take it down because the mural is not forever.
Sometimes, though, Toussaint is not okay with someone erasing his work. There's this one wall in particular he painted last year.
The mural was it's like something I represent Little Haiti. It says, welcome to Little Haiti. And then they had a view of somebody fishing, a nice boat, a beautiful woman with the hair braid. I mean, some Haitian culture work. And if you go right now to 62nd and Northeast 2nd Avenue, look what they put on there. That's offensive.
What's on there now is a geometric pattern all over the building. It's contemporary street art by another Haitian artist, actually. But Toussaint says it's offensive because he feels like his murals have a deeper purpose.
Like the heroes that fought for Haiti's freedom.
Right now, Toussaint has a new project he's working on, a mural tribute to his forefathers. It's on the wall of a building that belongs to a friend. It's going to be a store selling Haitian-inspired clothing.
He also do works that related to Haiti, his clothing stores, his shirts about Haiti and all that.
So it's a mural, but it's also like an ad for the business, right? Is that a thing that happens in Haiti?
Right. This is, you know, because the Haitian people like colors. You understand what I'm saying? And me as an artist, when I paint, now I don't only paint for you to see a view of Haiti. I also want you to know that that's what's going on in that particular business. Like if you go to a barbershop, there's some barbershops I painted, a dude with nice fade. You don't even know how to read. You know that's a barbershop.
But do you still consider then your murals art? They're not just an advertisement?
I'm an artist. I paint something that if you cannot afford to go to an art gallery, but if you're looking at my work, it's not only has something to do with the business, it's also a beauty of art, Haitian artworks.
Serge Toussaint makes his living painting these storefront murals, and he works for days and days on big ones, like this one honoring his Haitian forefathers.
That's going to be an awesome mural, man. It's one of my best pieces.
He says he wants it to make a big statement for many years to come. For the world, I'm Maria Muriel in Little Haiti, Miami.
And that's our statement today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.